On her first day in Formula One, a question she asked Bernie Eccleston inadvertently made him miss his wife's marathon. She was pushed to keep going live on air for 11 minutes straight as champagne was being poured down her back in the stinking Indian heat. Sky Sports broadcaster and author Rachel Brooks has been rising to the moment brilliantly ever since. I hope you enjoy this chat. Welcome back to Away We Go podcast. Are you ready?
It's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to Away We Go podcast, a Formula One podcast that goes beyond the track limits to talk about travel, food and lifestyle surrounding the sport. I'm your host, Diane Bortoletto, and today I'm in Margaret River and I've got a very special guest episode for you today. Oh, you might recognise her actually, the very lovely Rachel Brooks from Sky Sports. She's a Formula One broadcaster and author and a long-standing Formula One fan. Welcome to the show, Rachel.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you. I mean, you know, I watch you every race weekend on the TV when you're there covering Formula One. To a lot of people, looks like you've got the dream job. Is that how you'd describe it?
Yeah, definitely. I've been very, very, very lucky not only to get it, but to stay in it for so long. I've watched it since I was a kid. And yeah, it is the dream job. We don't forget that either. I literally this year in Australia in Melbourne was walking across the little pontoon bridge into the circuit. And I was with Bernie Collins and we just sort of looked around. There was a bright blue sky and the sun was out. And we just thought, God, you know, we're so lucky. So we do remember that.
Which is, it's nice to have those moments because I bet there's lots of pressure during those race weekends, especially, you know, dealing with live TV. You know, we've had a couple of technical glitches just trying to get on here. So I can't imagine all the challenges you'd have going live. Has there been a time where you're just like, oh, I just want to die because something's not worked or gone to plan?
I guess I'm probably a bit weird in that way. And I like the challenge of when things go wrong. So that kind of gets your brain working, gets you thinking more and gets you reacting on your feet more. And I love all that. That's part of the thrill of it, I think. If it all goes smoothly, it's like, oh, okay. But if you actually have a challenge and something goes wrong, then yeah, no, I love it. I was in India when Sebastian Vettel won his title in India that year. And I was actually doing a live for Sky Sports News at that moment. And it all just started happening behind me. So he was celebrating with his team and they're waiting for him to come out for the team photo. So they came to me live and then I just started talking. And then they were like, we're going to stay on you until, you know, we see the photo. And that's someone in your ear, obviously, saying that to you. So you just carry on talking. And then he's still not there for the photo. So you carry on talking and you carry on talking. And you try and remember all the stats from the year and all the races he's won and all the incidents. And you're trying to remember everything. And then he started to come out. So they stayed with me. So I carried on talking over the pictures and they were showing him in the team photo and then the celebrations. And then people were running around and I was still talking. I was hoping to try and grab hold of somebody, whether it was Seb or somebody. And his front end engineer, a guy called Ollie Shack, came over and just poured champagne on my head while I was live, which all ran down my back. And I carried on talking. I chatted to him briefly for a second. I grabbed him and got a few words from him. And then Adrian Newey came over and then Christian Horner. And I think it was about 11 or 12 minutes nonstop live in the end with no script, no questions really from the gallery because they just let me go with it. And then you're just relying on your wits. You're relying on everything you've remembered through the year and all the other work you've done to do it really. But I love moments like that. I absolutely love it. That's why we do live TV.
Oh my gosh. I can't imagine trying to keep your composure when you're in India. I mean, like, I guess it was really hot and sticky and you got champagne running down your back.
It was pretty grim.
Well done.
Yeah, but it was part of the moment. It was great. No, it was great to be involved.
So you started your career in, well, actually, I read somewhere that you were the first woman to do a live cricket broadcast for Sky Sports. Is that correct?
So, yeah. So I was doing them for Sky Sports News. So I was doing live cricket updates from the edge of the pitch for Sky Sports News. And I was the first woman they sent out to do that. We had women working on, I think Anita Rani was working on Cricket AM by that point. And we'd had some females appear in cricket broadcasts in terms of ex-players. But yeah, in terms of live updates from the edge of the pitch, yes, that was the first time they'd sent anyone out to do it. And it was quite scary. I love my cricket and I've watched cricket for a long time, but I would never assume to have the knowledge of an ex-player or anybody like that. So standing there trying to report on the game, that it was in Canterbury in Kent, I remember it so well. Standing on the edge of the pitch. I think I got there like 2 hours early as well on the day and stuff, just trying to be ready and standing at the edge of the pitch and just trying to update on the score and things and not get it wrong. Yeah, it was quite intimidating because the fans are all only like a foot or two away from you because they're all sitting there in their chairs around the edge of the pitch. So yeah, you have to get it right. But no, it was good. I loved it. And then I just carried on doing cricket for ages. I basically became their cricket person, like, if you like.
Oh, so where did your love of sports come from? Like, is it a family thing or have you just, did you play sports when you were growing up?
Yeah, I played all the sports at school. I was never first pick for the team, but I was always in the team. So I was kind of like the mid-range, if you like, I guess. And I played tennis, netball, rounders for my schools and hockey. And then I played a bit more tennis outside of school as well. And then, but then my brothers were sporty. My sister was really sporty. My sister played a lot of tennis to a good standard. So yeah, we've always been pretty sporty as a family. I've got two brothers and one sister and we were always playing sport at the weekends. We didn't have like phones or social media and stuff back then. So you got outside and you play games basically.
And then you've turned, you know, that love of sport into a career, you know, starting in radio. And then, yeah, like, tell us how you went from cricket and sport broadcasting to Formula One.
The sports, first of all, started at Talk Sport Radio. I did sort of commercial radio breakfast shows, you know, where you have a laugh in the morning and you muck around and you have a lot of fun, which even then I used to say to people, I get paid to get up and go and have a laugh. Like, that's my job, which I loved then. And then once I'd sort of done that for quite some time, done that for quite a few years, I had a friend was doing some bits at Talk Sport and said they were looking for people. And so I just went up and started working for them. And after a couple of years there, I'd been writing to the boss at Sky Sports News saying, look, I really want to come and work for you. What do I need to do? What experience do I need? And he wrote back and told me. And so I just carried on for 5 years writing to him saying, I want to come work for you one day. I want to come work for you one day. And then eventually he said, oh, come and have a chat. So I went in to meet him and I'd heard he was quite a tough boss. And so I thought, well, I've told him I like cricket, so I need to really know cricket if I'm going to go in and have a chat with him. And sure enough, when I went in to have the chat with him, he asked me questions about county cricketers. So in the UK, you've got the England national team and then you've got county teams throughout the country. And I thought, well, he's not going to ask me about the England team because that's too easy. Everyone knows about the England team. Well, that's easy. So I basically swatted up or did all my research on all the county cricketers and learned batting averages, bowling averages, all that kind of stuff. And then sure enough, he asked me some of them in my interview and I didn't get a single one wrong.
Oh, wow.
And so he said, oh, if you quit your job tomorrow, I'll give you a job tomorrow. That was when I was at TalkSport. So I walked back into TalkSport and quit my job and rang him up and said, I hope you're serious because I've just quit my job. And he said, yeah, yeah, come in. And then that's how I got into Sky. And then once I was in there, I thought I'd just be making tea and things. But on my first day, I got sent out on a reporter job to shadow somebody. And then that was it. I was on my own. So once I'd started doing the cricket for them, I did that for quite a while. I really enjoyed it. Obviously, in the winter, you go to the football games and cover the football. But then I'd always watched Formula One. And so when we got the rights for the Formula One in 2011 to broadcast in 2012, they said they were looking for a couple of reporters to work on it. So I put my hand up straight away, had an interview, had to do a presentation on what I thought the coverage would look like. And then, yeah, got one of the two jobs. And then after a year of that, the girls who were already working on the Sky F1 channel, the bespoke channel, one left, one got married, started having kids. So I just moved across onto the Sky F1 channel after a couple of years. And I've been there ever since.
Oh, wow. I mean, I love your interviews on Sky Sports. Obviously, that's what we get here in Australia. And I feel like you're very sensitive to the driver's emotions, very empathetic. That's how it comes across. And I love that, you know. I mean, it must be tough for you because I look at Lewis Hamilton and I think, oh my God, he's giving you nothing. Like he's so down. He's just shut down almost. He's not had a good race or a good experience or the car's not performing, whatever. And I really feel for you. I guess there's not a lot you can do in those kind of situations.
He's somebody who sort of really wears his heart on his sleeve. So it took a while, but I think the biggest thing you can do in my job is understand the personalities of each individual in front of you. So, for example, you know, Fernando Alonso will give you an interview, but if there's something he wants to get off his chest, he'll pepper it into his first answer and see if you pick up on it. And then it's up to you to pick up on that and follow up with it.
Right.
So he will try and give you something. Whereas for the likes of Max Verstappen, he's really honest. He's really honest with his answers. He's really blunt. He's like, this is what it was like. This is what happened. And this is, you know, what I think of it kind of thing. And he's really smart with his answers as well. I've got a lot of respect for Max. he never beats around the bush when it comes to giving you answers. He's just there and he's honest and he'll tell you like it is. But then with somebody like Lewis, he's very emotional and he wears his heart on his sleeve, and you can really tell how he feels from his answers as well. So I don't ever push it with Lewis. I think we're really lucky at the moment. We've got such a great bunch of drivers right now. So you just look at the person standing in front of you, and also, right, how's his race been? God, you know, he's way off the pace of his teammate, or he's had a rubbish qualifying. He's going to be feeling pretty low. You just got to see if you can get anything out of them or look for any positives in it. And if not, just let them go. Don't push it, because you're not going to get anywhere. They're not going to give you anything else if you push it. So, no. Yeah, it's you learn it over time, I guess. And I've got a really good relationship with all of them, I think. I mean, they all seem to say so. So, yeah, I think you also have to respect what they do. When they get out of the car, they're full of adrenaline and they might say something they regret later. So you always got to try and balance that out as well and say, look, you know, I understand you're full of adrenaline. It's an emotional moment kind of thing. And yeah, give them that benefit of the doubt.
I feel like you see them as a person first and then the work talent second, you know, like, which is great. And that comes across really well.
I was going to say, I did a race a few years ago in 2016. I got my license and did a race on a race weekend, an Eradical SR1, because I wanted to experience it. I wanted to properly experience understeer and oversteer and things like that, that, you know, I'm trying to understand what they're dealing with. But two, I learned so much from that weekend in that, I mean, all my practice was in the wet. So it was England in the summer and it just rained every time I got in the car. So I never felt I properly got everything out of the car. So I had those frustrations. Then in the first race, I spun on the last corner of the last lap. I didn't know it was the last lap because it was a timed race, not a number of laps race, but I'd just overtaken someone and I spun defending. I hit a wet patch and spun. So I got out of the car furious, and this little kid came up to me and said, oh, can I interview you for my website? And I was like, oh God, this is what it feels like when you get out of the car and you're absolutely furious and someone puts a microphone in your face. I honestly learned so much that weekend from how they must be feeling on a, you know, I was on a tiny scale. I was on a millionth scale of what they do, but I got an understanding of it all, which I think really helped as well.
I'm sure it did. Yeah. What an experience. Tell us about your very first day in Formula One. How did that go?
Well, I thought my first day was my last, because I turned up and it was China in 2012, and there'd been some stories in the newspaper, in the press, about the protests in Bahrain. And it had been, they basically didn't want the race to go there. And it was a bit, it was very on edge whether or not we were going to go to Bahrain that year. The race had been cancelled previously. So everyone was thinking, well, are we going to go or not? And there was a meeting in the paddock between all the team principals and Bernie Eccleston, who was running the sport at the time. And my then producer, I mean, we were very new in the paddock. We didn't know how everything worked. We didn't know the rules, essentially, of, you know, when you talk to people, when you don't, kind of thing. But my producer said, oh, just go and stand outside where they're having the meeting and see if you can doorstep Bernie, which is basically you just try and get an interview without asking permission beforehand. So I thought, oh God, okay. And, you know, all I'd heard of Bernie Eccleston was this fearful, you know, terrifying man who ran the sport, who could, you know, kick you out in half a second if he didn't like what you said. So anyway, he came out of this meeting and he spoke to Lee McKenzie first from the BBC, and there was a couple of words there, and he obviously knew Lee. And then he saw me, and I just kind of sort of put my microphone under him and sort of said, oh, you know, how was the meeting? And he said, yeah, it was good. It's good. Everyone's happy. And I said, everyone's happy to go to Bahrain? He said, yeah, everyone's happy. Everyone's going to Bahrain. And I said, are you going, Bernie? And he just stopped in his tracks in the middle of the paddock, and he turned and he looked at me. And he said, what a stupid question.
Nice.
And I was like, okay. And he said, it'll get a stupid answer or something along those lines. And he was like, of course I'm going, kind of thing. And then he carried on walking. And there were photographers there at the time, and they took photos of this moment. And all you see is me sort of vaguely smiling, putting a microphone under his nose, and Bernie's face just like, what is this person asking me? And there are all these written journalists around him with their dictaphones out, sort of poking them forward to try and get the answer and try and get an answer from him, and sort of that finished, and I let him go, and I was like, I don't think that went very well. And I got back to the hotel that night, and there was a producer there from the BBC, and he just said to me, oh, good luck getting in tomorrow, see if your pass works tomorrow after that. And I was like, what? He was like, he wasn't going to Bahrain, he was going to watch his wife in the London Marathon, but you've now made him go to Bahrain to the race because you asked him if he was going on camera. I was like, oh God. So I had a very sleepless night. I then got in the next day and went to the swipe gates, and everyone was just looking at me to see if I could get back into the paddock or not. And I did get in, and I've been there ever since.
Oh, phew. What about baptism of fire. Oh my God, I feel stressed just listening. Just listening to that. I've never even met Bernie Ecclestone, but just hearing about him and everything I've read and seen, wow. Yeah, I would have been shaking in my boots. Yeah. On a first day, gosh. And then how was your relationship with him after that? Like, was he a bit frosty for a while or did he just
No, he was great. He was great. I interviewed him quite a few times. I went to his offices in London once and I sat down. I mean, it's quite intimidating there because it's very quiet. There was just the lady at the reception desk and then she took me through into this little room and then there was a table and we sat at this table. He came in, he sat down, he said, right, now what are you going to ask me today? And I opened my notebook and he put his hand out and he went, I'll tell you what you're going to ask me today. And he literally told me the questions to ask him, but that's kind of how we operated. But he was very, very successful.
He certainly was. And wow. So like from the Bernie Ecclestone era to the Liberty Media era, I mean, the sport has just like it's exploded. It's changed. Well, the sport itself hasn't changed so much, but the circus feels like it's just grown so much. Has that impacted your job in the paddock, like reporting on Formula One? And also wanted to throw in Drive to Survive, like having that crew there, you know, shadowing drivers and team principals and trying to capture snippets of conversations and interviewing people. I mean, does that impact you guys?
So from the Liberty point of view, they've been phenomenal for the sport. I mean, they have opened up the sport to an audience that we weren't reaching and we would never reach the way we were going. So that's been phenomenal. Bringing in Drive to Survive was huge. I mean, that's the whole reason that I wrote my book, is for the audience to understand a bit more about it, to learn more about it, to know more about the people and the characters involved and what it takes to drive a Formula One car. But the Drive to Survive audience have taken it with both hands and really sort of got stuck in. So it's not, I meet so many people now who are passionate fans, but they only came to it through Drive to Survive. We used to travel around the world and meet people and they'd say, oh, what do you do? And we're like, oh, I work in Formula One. And they're like, well, what's that? Or is that where the cars go round and round? But everybody knows the sport now. It's completely different when we go around the world, especially in America and places. It's amazing what they've done for it. So yeah, it's huge. The only downside I would say for us is that we used to have very, very good access to all the drivers and to all the teams. And we used to get a lot of interviews and one-on-ones. And that's massively, massively cut back. Not only because of F1, but also because the teams themselves do their own media. And so they take the time that the drivers used to give across to media now is so restricted that I miss that side of it. Yeah, we definitely don't do anywhere near as many one-to-one interviews where you really get to know the driver. We don't get to do as many of those anymore.
Like you said, the teams have got a direct line to their fans now, like rather than having to go through, you know, media.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Now your book, you mentioned your book. So yeah. Your motivation is what, to help fans understand the sport. But I mean, you travel a lot all throughout the year. Like, where do you find time to sit down and write a book?
So it was March last year. And so I've been writing fiction for a while. I love writing fiction. That's my passion. I've been doing that just in the background anyway. And so I was speaking with a literary agent about this fiction because we were trying to sell one of them. And she said, this publisher's asked me if you'd write a non-fiction. And I was like, okay, what about? She was like, well, it's about Formula One, but it's basically for the Drive to Survive audience to understand more about the sport and the characters and, you know, how the sport works kind of thing. Anyway, so I said, well, let me have a think about it. And I went away and I immediately wrote out the chapter titles. I knew immediately what every chapter title would be. And I thought, actually, you know, this would be really interesting to do for me to, I mean, my head is full of so much F1 information from all the years, to dump all that onto some pages. But then as I was writing it, I realized that I was discovering a lot of stuff because nonfiction, wow, hats off to anyone who writes one because it takes a lot of work. It takes so much work. The research, the interviews, everything that goes into it. And I realized that I was learning stuff through it as well. So I went back to the publishers almost and said, look, this isn't just the Drive to Survive audience. This is longstanding fans as well, because I'm learning a lot out of writing this. So I think the appeal's sort of much wider. Anyway, they said, yes, let's do it. But can you get it done by September the 1st?
Oh, wow.
So I had less than 6 months to write it. So yeah. I was... every day that I had off, so I was doing my job. I never did any at the racetracks or race weekends because you have to focus on what you're doing. So on any day off I had, I was sitting here basically all day. And I found that I'm not a great writer in the morning. I'm much better once it gets to midday, my brain gets in gear and I can write. But up until that point, I gave myself the morning off, basically. But then I would write till 6, 7, 8 in the evening because I enjoyed it so much. And once I got going, I just didn't want to stop. So I just got it all down by the 1st of September. And then you go through edits and you go through all sorts of processes after that. Yeah. And so now it's quite scary that it's going to be out and people are reading it. I've had a couple of reviews already, which has been amazing because they've loved it. So it's been great. But yeah, it's quite scary that all that is now going out into the open because it was just me sitting here writing it. And now suddenly people are reading it. So yeah, that's going to be weird. But I've loved it. I mean, there's so much I discovered writing it. For example, one of my main reasons for writing it was Max Verstappen keeps putting his car on pole and his teammate is out in Q1. How does that happen when you're in the same machinery? You've got basically the best car on the track. What is going on? And so through that, I discovered the techniques that Max uses, the incredible skills he has, the ability he has, the feel he has on the pedals that other drivers just don't have. That's something that's innate in him that you can't teach. You can't learn, you know, you can learn a little bit of it, but to a greater extent, it is within you. And then I discovered, you know, what makes someone great at defensive driving, what makes someone great in the wet, what makes somebody a world champion, essentially. And so it all built up into the book. And then there are some stories about the little extra things that drivers do, like Nico Rosberg tells the story of when he was teammates with Michael Schumacher and they were in Monaco and it was just before qualifying. And there are very few toilets in Monaco in the pit lane, in the paddock. There are very few toilets because of the location and the logistics of it all. So he went to the team toilet to try and use it. And Michael was in there and he knocking on the door like, Michael, Michael, and no answer. And he knew he was in there. And it got really close to the time to get in the car. And so Nico was like, I'm going to have to do something else. And he grabbed an oil bucket. And he peed in an oil bucket and then had to go and run and get in his car. And he said he was all flustered when he got in the car. And sure enough, with like 3 minutes to go, Michael came out of the toilet casually, just strolled over to his car. And Nico said it completely threw off his qualifying. Yeah, that was on his mind. And he was cross and he was, you know, not ready for qualifying and it threw him off. And he said he learned from Michael the little tricks you can do to get into your teammate's head. So there's a chapter on all that stuff as well about how the little extra 1% that world champions have and things they do.
Wow. Yeah. How interesting. Yeah. I can't wait to read it. So it's called F1 Racing Drive.
Yes. We wanted to call it F1 Drive, but legally you can't do that. So we had to put the word racing in. So it's F1 Racing Drive. That's a very long story. I discovered I never knew all the legalities of writing a book either. I was completely, yeah, very naive.
As in legalities around Formula One and writing a book?
Yes, because they're a trademark, because they've got their own trademark and things. Yeah.
Yes, this podcast had to change its name earlier this year because it had F1 in the name.
Yeah, so you understand.
I've learned that lesson as well. Yes, I do understand, yes. That was a process having to change. And all social media, all URLs, all everything. But here we are. Oh, fantastic. So the book is out on early May, the 7th of May.
And 7th May, yeah.
And you can pre-order it on Amazon.
Yeah, it should be everywhere soon, hopefully. By the 7th, it will be everywhere.
Fabulous. And we'll put a link in show notes so you can go Rachel's book. We'll put a link in show notes and you can go and buy Rachel's book, which is F1 Racing Drive. I can't wait to read it myself. Very exciting. Now, I want to talk a little bit about travel. Because you are flying so much and traveling to all these fantastic destinations, firstly, like, how do you deal with jet lag? Like, your body just must be all over the place sometimes.
Yeah, it is something you end up just kind of dealing with. I mean, we're quite lucky in that a lot of the time when we come back, we are off until the next race because we're away so much. So you may have meetings and phone calls and things, but in terms of doing a 9-to-5 when you land, it's not quite the same for us. So we are very fortunate in that. I know for a lot of the teams, when they get back, they go straight into the factories and they go straight into a normal working week, which is really, really tough. For me, I kind of got to a point where I was like, okay, I'm awake in the middle of the night. I'm just going to have to like watch something, chill out and not stress about it. I will sleep eventually because you always know you will catch up. I think it got to a point last year, at the end of last year, I think I've got one of those fitness rings that tracks everything. And it told me that I was 29 hours in sleep debt.
Oh.
So, which takes a ridiculous, it takes like a month to get that back, if not longer. Yeah, I realized at that point last year, I was like, okay, I need to get some sleep soon. This is crazy. Because when you're away as well, you never get 8 hours or 9 hours sleep in a night. You might get back from track at like 6 or 7 in the evening, sometimes later. you dump your stuff in your room, you try and grab dinner somewhere, and then you're eating late as well. So you don't sleep as soon as you get back to your room. So you're going to sleep at like midnight, one in the morning, and you're up at 5 or 6. So there are long days while you're away as well.
Yeah, and you're probably like reading and researching and keeping an eye on all the news and making sure that, you know, you're across absolutely everything that's happening that weekend. Yeah. So yeah, I can imagine it would be, the adrenaline. I imagine you're full of adrenaline yourself, like doing live TV trackside. So, you know, that's got to subside to help you sleep. So do you have any tricks? Like, when I travel, I always bring earplugs, just always. And it sounds a bit weird, but lavender essential oils, and I put a couple of drops on my pillow, and it just, I don't know, I use it at home. So it just reminds me of home and just helps me. Well, I feel like it helps me sleep. But do you do anything like that?
No, I don't have anything. The only thing I have is I have some really light TV shows that you can fall asleep to. So nothing that requires any brain power. And I always have those on my iPad. So if I'm awake in the middle of the night, I'll just put something on that I can fall asleep to. I'll do that. But no, I don't really have any tricks. Never found anything that works. I mean, a lot of people take melatonin and things, but that doesn't work on me. I've tried it twice and it never worked. So no, I don't have any tricks, I'm afraid. No secrets.
Yeah, I guess if you're awake in the middle of the night now, you can start working on book two, right?
Yeah. Well, this is it. I do have some more I want to write. So yeah, I am in conversations at the moment about another nonfiction and some fiction. So yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Fit them all in.
Yes. Yeah. So how many races do you typically go to each season?
It's around 15 or 16. I did do the entire season in 2019. I did every race, but it was only, God, how many races was it that year? It's a good point. I can't remember. But now that it's 24, no one does all 24 races. Not from our side anyway, because it's just too much. It's too much to do. I did 20 races 2 years ago, and that was a lot. Yeah. That's when I got appendicitis in Baku. So I only ended up doing 18, but I was due to do 20.
Yeah, right. Gosh. Before you're walking out the door, what do you always take with you? Besides the obvious, passport, wallet, phone, what do you always travel with?
I always travel with my iPad and my AirPods. And my iPad is always stocked up with stuff to watch because I never watch what's on the plane anymore. I don't know. I just gave up. When I started this job, I remember always the first race going to Australia was always around Oscar time, and all the Oscar films would be on the plane. And I was like, oh, I'm going to watch all the Oscar films. And I did that for the first few years and then just gave up. I don't know whether dates moved or whatever. So AirPods and iPad and portable battery chargers for phones and stuff. And then I sometimes take cereal bars because I'm not a big fan of plain food. I've had food poisoning from one airline's food and it put me off, so I don't really tend to eat on the plane much anymore. So I take snacks with me, and I always try and buy something fresh at the airport, like a fresh sandwich or a fresh salad or something at the airport to eat on the plane, in case I'm not a big one for eating plane food anymore.
Do they fly you at the front of the plane, or are you sitting at the back with everyone else?
Depends on the journey time. If it's over 6 hours, then we fly business, but indirect. We never fly direct in business. So we'll fly indirect business if it's over 6 hours. And if it's less than 6 hours, it's always economy.
But, could you upgrade with your own points, or do you have to?
You can, but we don't buy the tickets. So usually if you upgrade with the points, I think you have to buy your own ticket. I think that's what the rule is. So no, I haven't done that. And it's and economy for less than 6 hours is fine. Economy, like, our guys have to travel in economy all the time, our tech crew and people. So yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for them. They fly direct, but I have a lot of sympathy for them because that is tough for all the crew. The engineers, mechanics, it's incredibly tough. We are so, so lucky when we do the long hauls because, I don't know how they do those journeys and then get off a flight and then go into work.
Yeah, and especially this year too, with what's going on in the Middle East and having all those flights diverted and Australia being so far away from their bases. Like, I was hearing stories of people taking 39 hours to get to Melbourne and and then having to perform at the highest level in motorsport. Yeah. No, not cool. So, Rachel, do you get to choose where you stay, or does Sky Sports, do they just book all your travel and you're just staying?
No, they book our hotels and our flights and everything, and we all stay together in one hotel. So, we just go wherever they've booked us in usually.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, with the explosion of the sport and now that Formula One is so huge? I mean, do you get people wanting selfies and autographs and stuff because they see you on TV in Formula One?
Yeah, that's definitely changed. People do know you when you get to places now. Yeah, that's definitely changed over the last 14, 15 years of doing this, for sure. I mean, you could arrive in the past and people wouldn't even know there was a Formula One race on, let alone what you were there for. But yeah, no, that's definitely changed a lot.
Yeah. Does that impact you? Is it nice or is it?
No, it's always, no, it's always a privilege. Always a privilege. Because, like I say, we used to do it when no one even really paid any attention to the sport. So it's amazing now to have all these fans and people watching as well what you do and the messages we get and stuff. No, it's lovely. It's really, really nice. You'd never say no to a photograph or no, it's a privilege. Absolutely.
Awesome. Tell us about presidential protocols.
So we don't always know which guests are coming to races. Right. So you'll get to race day and you'll get sent a list of kind of like celebs they're expecting and people who've been invited and things, or people who might have said yes. But we were in Austin one year and President Bill Clinton turned up, and our guys had tried to sort of grab a word with him on the grid and they hadn't been able to. And then he came out into the pit lane where I do the toilet run interviews with the drivers, and I saw him. So I just went over and said, Bill, can I get a word for Sky TV? And he's got all these enormous security guys around him. And I managed to get his attention. He turns around. Security guys stop like saying no, but he looks like he'll talk. So I just asked him a quick couple of questions and then let him go. Anyway, it got played out. And then I got all these messages from people saying, you called him Bill? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, he's Mr. President forever. And I didn't realize that American presidents, even when they're not president anymore, still get called Mr. President. And so all these Americans were saying, I can't believe you called him Bill. And he responded, I don't know. I didn't know the rules. I didn't know you had to still call him Mr. President. I know now. But yeah, so it was, yeah, I just spoke to Bill Clinton. And then the comments and the feedback was just insane, insane. But I know
gosh.
Now.
Gosh. Yeah. Did like his office or any of his people get in touch?
No, they were great. Nobody like said anything. Yeah. No, I mean, the security did. Well, they could to like stop people talking to him, but he stopped and talked to me. So they let it happen. And then, yeah, that was that. But yeah, it was quite mad.
Yeah, geez, you'd have to be quite brave doing your job as well. Just being able to do exactly that, like call out to a former US president, you know, and ask for a comment. Like, have you ever been starstruck?
Oh, yeah, loads. I was offered the chance to sit down with Tom Brady and Lewis Hamilton in Miami a few years ago and do an interview with them. And you kind of like, I don't think we appreciate the fame of American sports stars like him over here. And so when I got there and the fuss that was around him, it's a similar sort of fuss that Lewis gets, obviously, because they're both, you know, megastars. But that was really, really cool. I really enjoyed that. I got to sit down and chat to both of them on the golf course in Miami in this beautiful backdrop. Very, very lucky. And then when we got to the track, there's one person who I finally met in Las Vegas last year, who I've been wanting to meet for years, and he's a basketball player. He is my favorite basketball player. Jimmy Butler used to play for Miami Heat, now Golden State Warriors. And I followed and I've been to their games. And a couple of years ago, I missed the Miami Grand Prix. It wasn't one of my races that year. And my friend was there working and managed to get a photo with him and sent it to me while I was sat at home. And I was so mad. And I was like, that's the one person I want to meet. That's the one person I want a selfie with. We're lucky. We meet all these people. We meet the Tom Bradys and all the drivers and all these people. But he was the one person. And then last year in Vegas, he was there at the race. And I was sat in McLaren during the race or during qualifying. It must have been during the race, having a cup of coffee or something before I went to the pen because it was freezing cold. And he walked in and I just sat there and I was just like, oh my God, this is my chance to try and get a picture with him. And I went over and spoke to him and his friend watched our stuff. And he was like, oh yeah, you're Rachel. I know what you do and all this, you know. And he was like, oh, did you want a picture? And I was like, yeah, hell yeah. And then I had a conversation with him and I was like, okay, tick. And yeah, I was buzzing. And it's mad because you do meet all these like amazing megastars. But for me, he was somebody that I really wanted to meet and wanted. I don't tend to get selfies with famous people really, but he was one person where I was like, I really want a selfie with him.
Yeah, I used to work in major events as well in Perth, and we'd often have, you know, big sports stars, Roger Federer and et cetera, coming over. And the one person I was shocked that I got tongue-tied was Steve Waugh, like the Australian cricketer.
Oh wow, yeah.
Also a big cricket fan. Well, back then in those days of, you know, Shane Warne, Steve Waugh, that era, And you and I met, Steve Ball. I actually couldn't speak. Like, I was like, I just felt like such an idiot, but I did get a photo and it was at a function. And then, a couple of drinks later, everyone was having fun together. So, it was a moment though, but I was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, I was similar when I met Adam Gilchrist in Australia like a few years ago, because I remember him from that Ashes and it was just him behind the stumps, bowling Warnie, bowling Shane. Nice, Shane, nice. And then I met him and he was so lovely. He was nice. Yeah. I was like, awesome.
Realities of the job. Yeah, like I said at the start of the show, it looks like you've got the dream job from the outside, but I'm sure it's not all roses. I'm sure you're missing birthdays and family events and things because you're at a race weekend, which, you love it. You're passionate about it. That's obvious. But, tell us about some of the realities of the job that maybe people don't realise.
Yeah, I mean, this year, I think that was the first Easter I've spent with family, God, for as long as I can remember. Easter always tends to have fallen on a race weekend. So that was, that's really lovely when you get to be at those. Like, it's my dad's birthday on Monday, and I'm getting to spend time with him. Whereas, if you've been doing Bahrain and Saudi, you wouldn't have necessarily been able to do that. My mum's birthday always falls on Australia week. So I've missed that for years, like years and years and years. It's always that week in Australia, or like the first race of the season, essentially, always ties in. It's birthday, anniversary and Mother's Day. I tend to miss all three every single year. So yeah, you miss a lot of things. It is very glamorous and we are very lucky, but you land, you go to a hotel, you go to a track, you go back to the hotel, you grab food anywhere you can nearby just because you want to go to bed and sleep because you're up early again the next day. So it's a lot of hotel track, hotel track, hotel track. The chance to view these places, I got better at it for a while in terms of trying to extend stays and just book a flight home a few days later and just find myself a hotel somewhere or go and travel a bit. But then life takes over as well and you need to get home and you need to get back and do stuff. So no, it is amazing, but it is, you miss out on a lot of things, birthdays, weddings, all that kind of stuff. And then, it's a bit of a hamster wheel sometimes as well when you're there. We're very lucky, but we also, I think in Japan, we stay in a place that is 2.5 hours south of Tokyo. So it's not Japan as you know it. It's not Japan as, a lot of people imagine. So if you want to see, real Japan, you need to stay out there longer and then go and travel into Tokyo or something, which some of our guys did this year, which was great. I'd love to say we get out and about and we travel loads and see loads of places, but the reality of it is you don't. You get in, you do your job, you get out, you get home.
And I guess when you've got time off, you probably don't want to travel, do you? Or do you...
No, what? I mean, this is the winter we just had is the first winter I haven't been away since starting the job because I just couldn't face it. I couldn't face getting my suitcase out and going away somewhere again. I just wanted to plant myself at home for a while. So yeah, that's the first time I haven't actually gone away in the winter.
How do you even keep a routine going, like a fitness routine, when you're traveling so much? Like, is it just discipline? Like, okay, you're in a hotel, you're going to use their gym no matter what? Like, I can't.
Oh, I'm terrible at that. Others are really good at it. Bernie, all the ex-drivers are really good at going to the hotel gym, finding the time. Bernie Collins is good at it, but she says she tends to just end up going on a Thursday and then the rest of the weekend's gone. I do a lot when I'm at home. And so when I'm away, I kind of don't feel as guilty. So I'll do tennis 3 or 4 times a week, Pilates 3 or 4 times a week. Every week I'm at home and then hope I've got some in stock basically for while I'm away, because I just don't. When you get back in the evening, it's not possible because you are literally 2 minutes and you're out the door to try and grab some food somewhere and then sleep. And in the morning, if I go to the gym and then have to shower and wash my hair and get ready and everything afterwards, I've got to be up like 3 hours before the bus goes. Yeah. I'm not doing that when the bus is leaving at 7:30. So no. I don't tend to find the time. We used to run the track a lot, which I found was good. So say at the end of the day on a Thursday, you would run the track. And depending how fast you were, because they're usually around 5K, would take you 25 minutes, half an hour or whatever. I was longer than that. And so I had to time it. If there was enough time between me starting my run and the bus leaving, did I have time to run the track? And if I didn't have a safe hour, it wouldn't take me an hour. It would take me like 35 minutes. But if I didn't have the hour to get there, do the run, get back, get my stuff and get on the bus, then I didn't do it. So, and our buses tend to leave really promptly now. So yeah, I just don't do that anymore. I just feel guilty and come home and make up for it instead. It's fine.
Yeah. Make up for it when you're at home and then, you're in your usual place with your usual instructors and, whatnot. All right, Rachel. Well, let's dive into the final three. These are the three questions that we ask all of our guests that come on the podcast. Sure. So if you could go to a Formula One race for a holiday on a non-race weekend, which Formula One destination would you choose to go to and why?
So if it's what we would call short haul here or Europe, I would say Hungary. I'd definitely go to Hungary. Budapest's a fantastic city. It's great. The weather's always great the week we're there. You can get to the track easily. The taxis are really efficient. There's a really good system. I would definitely say go to Budapest. Love it there. Love the track. Love the city. It's fantastic. And then if you're going long haul, I would go to Austin in Texas. Again, love the circuit. Fans are amazing. And then the actual city just embraces it. And it's so much fun in the city itself. Go out for dinner, great food, live music everywhere. Just a really good atmosphere. Yeah, I would love it. I would definitely say Hungary for Europe and Texas for long haul.
And because you've traveled to so many Grand Prix for so many years and been to all of them, I'm going to ask you a slightly different question. Is if you could go to any Grand Prix that's not on the calendar anymore, which Grand Prix would you choose to go to and why?
Oh, that's an interesting one. I mean, for my visiting, I only go back as far as 2012. So I would choose one that's been since 2012. I would say Malaysia, but it was so hot and so humid the entire time. You just felt uncomfortable and sweaty all the time, even though it's a beautiful place. I only went to India once, and that was amazing. Culturally, just everywhere is a photo. It's just a beautiful, beautiful place, and the people are amazing. But when we did Mugello, the race in Mugello in COVID times, and we stayed in an olive grove, a hotel with like an olive grove and with lemon trees everywhere, and just the most spectacular backdrop. I think it was actually a vineyard, but it was just stunning. And then, no, I loved that. And I also loved Portimão in Portugal. I also loved that as well. So it might be one of those, to be fair, maybe Mugello, because of just where we stayed and the beautiful scenery around it.
Sounds magic.
Yeah, it was amazing.
If you could go on holiday with any Formula One driver, dead or alive, who would you choose to holiday with and why?
Wow. Depends what sort of holiday you want to go on. I think if you just wanted a wild time, you'd go with like a James Hunt, wouldn't you? But then if you wanted to really, I would love to have met Ayrton Senna. I would love to have met Ayrton Senna and had a conversation with Ayrton Senna, because the stuff I found out about him when writing the book, he just sounds like such an interesting person. And he was the first driver essentially to use telemetry when, you know, the data they were getting then was nothing compared to what they get now. But he really, really went into all of that to study and understand and to learn and things. And the people who worked with him then, I've got a couple of them that talk about it in my book. And they talk about the way he approached things. And I just think he'd have been a fascinating person to sit down with and spend time with.
Good answer. Good answer. Well, Rachel Brooks, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And
thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure, you know, chatting with you about your career, about your new book, F1 Racing Drive that's coming out, and hearing all these Formula One stories and cricket stories. Yeah, it's been a real pleasure. And guys, if you've liked what you've listened to, please rate and review the show. Please subscribe. Hello, if you're watching on YouTube, you can find us on all the social media platforms. All the links will be in the show notes, as well as links to Rachel's book and her social media. Instagram, right?
Yes, Instagram and TikTok and X. Yeah, all three.
Great. And yeah, we'll put all those links in the show notes. So thank you very much for having us in your ears. Until next week and until lights out. Away We Go podcast is produced by Diane Bortoletto. Oh, that was amazing. Oh, I could sit here talking to you all day.
Oh, bless you.